Welcome to RHRealityTech.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing Melissa Silverstein about her new book on female directors. Anti-choice extremists make a bid to wrest control away from Virginia's Republican Party, and an abstinence-only propagandist is exposed by a high school student with a smartphone in Tennessee. One bit of good news from the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court will not hear a case involving Planned Parenthood. Indiana passed a law stripping Medicaid payments to the group because it performs abortions. But an appeals court ruled the law went too far. More than a dozen states have similar laws or are considering them. The justices made no comment in denying Indiana's appeal.
The money in question does not go to abortion, but in fact largely goes to preventing abortion by allowing women to access medical services and specifically contraception that helps prevent unwanted pregnancy. Virginia is a politically moderate state. I know it's hard to believe it after all the crazy anti-choice legislation they've been up to lately, but Virginia reliably swings between the two parties. Indeed, because so much national attention has been paid to the hardline conservatives who've gotten power lately, it was reasonable to assume that Virginia's Republican voters would be interested in running someone for governor more moderate and less obsessed with controlling women and gays than they've had for the past couple of years. Because of that, Ken Cuccinelli, the current attorney general who has single-handedly gotten an enormous amount of national attention because of his attacks on women and gays, decided that he couldn't win at a traditional primary for the gubernatorial nomination. So he decided he didn't have to. Rachel Maddow reports.
Because he is who he is, because his base of support is so far out there on the edge, Mr. Cuccinelli apparently decided this year that he could not secure the Republican nomination for governor in his state in the usual way. Virginia Republicans usually pick their nominees by holding a primary where everybody across the state gets to vote. But what Ken Cuccinelli needed in order to get the Republican nomination was actually for just a few people to vote. The right few people. The very, very, very far right few people. And so Ken Cuccinelli used his wiles and his political muscle to change the rules. He got the Republican Party to agree that this year they would pick the nominee for governor, not by a statewide vote in a primary, but instead at a convention, because conventions are where the ideological hardcores go for a pleasant weekend of tricorn hats and pledges to keep the federal government off your lawn.
Why was Cuccinelli afraid of facing up to a traditional primary in Virginia? I can't read his mind, but I suspect it has a lot to do with his known track record of hostility to gays and to women's reproductive rights, even though the current governor of Virginia, Bob McDonnell, drew unwanted national attention when Virginia Republicans tried to pass a law requiring women seeking abortion to undergo an extra, unnecessary transvaginal ultrasound to go with a condescending lecture. McDonnell was nicknamed Governor Ultrasound because of this. But it didn't stop Ken Cuccinelli from working tirelessly with the State Board of Health to pass a bunch of unnecessary regulations that are likely to close every clinic in the state but one. In fact, there's a lot of sex-related opinions Cuccinelli has that caused him to only want the hardest right of the right to be able to vote in the primary.
If Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli's name sounds at all familiar, it might be from when he was in the news from trying to keep sodomy illegal in Virginia, because as he said in 2009, quote, homosexual acts are wrong. They're just intrinsically wrong. And I think in a natural law-based country, it's appropriate to have policies that reflect that. Or maybe it was from when he approved strict building code regulations that would put Virginia's abortion providers out of business. The name Cuccinelli might also ring a bell. From that time, he urged Virginia's public colleges and universities to get rid of their policies that ban discrimination based on sexual orientation. Noticing a pattern here?
It was a clever plan, or it seemed that way, until Cuccinelli found that the same system meant other extremists could get nominated, extremists who are less careful about how they state their extreme opinions in public. That's how E.W. Jackson, a fundamentalist minister who has previously failed to get elected to public office, managed to secure the nomination for lieutenant governor, even though he has a tendency to say things like this.
Well, let's just take a listen at what E.W. Jackson has to say about reproductive choice.
Planned Parenthood has been far more lethal to black lives than the KKK ever was.
I have to remind everyone that this claim is just a way of saying that black women and the men who support them are worse for black people, of which women are half, than the KKK. Why? Because black women and women of all races go to Planned Parenthood for contraception and occasionally for abortion if they need it. Attacking the organization is just a way to attack the idea of women controlling their own fertility. Thus, Jackson is saying that black women who want to limit and space their births, often so they can take better care of the children that they do have, are worse for black people than the Klan. Jackson doesn't care much for gay people either.
The military has been decimated by this lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender policy that has now been implemented.
Their minds are perverted. They're frankly very sick people psychologically and mentally and emotionally, and they see everything through the lens of homosexuality. When they talk about love, they're not talking about love. They're talking about homosexual sex. Homosexuality is a horrible sin. It poisons culture. It destroys families. It destroys societies. It brings the judgment of God, unlike any very few things that is we can think of.
It's worth noting that the main reason that Jackson is a problem for Cuccinelli is that he has an intemperate tongue. Cuccinelli's public statements have indicated that he completely agrees with everything Jackson says, but he says so more elliptically, to make it harder to contest the public image of a moderate he's trying to project in order to win the race for Virginia's governor's seat. I'd like to welcome Melissa Silverstein to the program. Melissa is the founder and editor of Women and Hollywood, one of the most respected sites for issues related to women and film, as well as other areas of pop culture. Melissa recently published a new book about female directors titled In Her Voice, Women Directors Talk Directing. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Melissa.
Happy to be here.
So, directing is sadly one of the most male-heavy occupations there is out there. How did you drum up 40 separate female directors to interview when there's so much discrimination and other obstacles that keep women out of the role?
Well, when I started writing my blog, which goes back almost 6 years now, one of the things I discovered as a person who was interested in women's voices was there was very few out there, and I had to be really proactive in finding these women directors and getting them to talk to me. Because there are so few women directors, and sadly, a lot of my compatriots who write are not necessarily interested in women directors because they direct sometimes, or most of the time, smaller movies, which we can talk about in a moment, I had a lot of access pretty quickly to these women. And I just found that their stories were really important to tell because culture and films, all these things are a reflection of who we are, and if we don't reflect the diversity of stories and the diversity of people out there, then we're not getting all experiences.
And so it was just really a matter of building up your reputation slowly but surely.
Yes. And I was really deliberate in the movies that I went to see. I live in New York, so I have access to a lot of screenings. I researched really carefully about what was opening and then reached out to the publicist, made sure I saw the films, and then went to press days or did phoners or whatever way I could to access these people, the women.
That's a lot of work. Well, I appreciate you sharing your results.
It was a lot of work. And then when the interviews went up, and my blog has gone through three phases. It was on Blogger at first, then on WordPress self-hosted, and now it lives on a site called IndieWire, which is a industry site. And the interviews that are on in this book, which is volume one, and we are actually already working on volume two, were all interviews that were on the first two incarnations of this site. And so it was really about not letting these interviews kind of get lost and bringing them back up and saying, you know, even though they're old, they still have things that can offer to people who are interested in this business. one of the things for me was when I used to go into bookstores when they existed, I would always go to the film row and, you know, and I'd look around and there was always just books on dudes, dudes, dudes. And I was just like, I want to see a book about women. And I want young women who want to be directors to see these opportunities. I did self-publish this, so, you know, breaking into bookstores is going to be a challenge, but breaking into film schools is going to be hopefully a bit easier. So that's the objective, is really to get this book into film schools so that young men and young women can be exposed to these new voices. They're not new, these voices.
So how many of your interviews are more of with indie directors than mainstream Hollywood directors? And would you say that the indie film world is better to women than the mainstream Hollywood world?
Well, clearly the indie world is better to women. You can just see by the statistics and you can see by the movies that they make. Hollywood operates very simply. It's all about big action movies and about superheroes. Women seem to be shut out of those, and so there are not a lot of women who are directing $100 million budget movies, which are like on the low end now of these superhero movies. So most all the people that you will see in my book are people who have released indie movies, release them on their own. There's a couple of studio movies in here, and a bunch of documentaries, and, you know, it's the life cycle of a female director, that you are pretty much in the indie space. As women try to break in further, you know, we'll have more success, but it is it's a glass ceiling on those jobs.
I've often found that women in male-dominated professions sometimes shy away from identifying as feminist, instead often viewing themselves as one of the boys, or even denying that women generally face discrimination in their field. Was that your experience talking to female directors?
You know, sometimes it was. I agree with you, and I think that this is part of the problem with the fact that there are so few women that are visible in this business, is that they don't want to be called the woman director. And the greatest example we can have is to talk about Kathryn Bigelow and how she never, ever, ever talked about gender. With her, you know, win for Best Director, the only woman to have won Best Directing Oscar, and also the stuff surrounding Zero Dark Thirty. The women that I talk to a lot of times will talk about issues related to gender and how they are, you know, get their jobs, what it's like to pitch for a job. I think the conversation around gender is actually shifting a bit beyond the kind of like programs that are where are the women directors, kind of how women are going to break through to that next level and what they need to do to access it. That's a good conversation.
Speaking of Kathryn Bigelow and her just avoidance of the discussion of gender, what do you think is the value in that? Why is there such a strong temptation to just ignore the question altogether?
I just think it's comfort. I think if she started talking about gender, that's all she would ever get asked. And then the movie would probably get lost. And she seems to have made a concerted effort. You can see by the work product that she does, as well as how she presents herself. And in the interviews, she was hardly alone for Zero Dark Thirty at the beginning. She was always with Mark Bull. As things shifted in the kind of Oscar race, then she started coming out and talking a little bit more on her own, owning this film. So I think part of the problem for her and other women at that level is that you're the only one. So you are everything to everyone. So I, you know, just was having a conversation with someone today, and the person said, you know, they don't think there's an issue for women directors, and then they go, Kathryn Bigelow. Like, having one person win an award in 85 years means that there's no sexism. But the perception is that there's no sexism.
Yeah, just literally as soon as one person's in the door, it's over. That's all you need.
Exactly. But you look at what Brenda Chapman is doing with Brave, and the person she created this character, she saw it through the beginning of the fate of, you know, production and everything like that. And then she was let go from this movie that was basically her baby about her daughter. And now the cycle is shifting into one, you know, best animated film and all the stuff that's going on now with them kind of rebranding her fierce heroine as a kind of quote unquote Disney princess. She's used her voice to say, nah, this is not what I wanted for this character. She might be a princess, but a princess is not a Disney princess per se. And I'm really respect what she's been saying in the last couple of weeks. And it's not easy to do that.
No. I mean, it seems like it's an industry where it can be very punishing to speak your mind.
Very punishing. And also, and then you don't get jobs. People just shut on you, and it's not safe, and it's sad.
So what would it take to get more women into directing roles in Hollywood, do you think?
I think they just need to hire women. I think they need to get over this kind of, like, bugaboo, that women can't direct big-budget movies. Well, they clearly produce big-budget movies. I mean, a woman led the Spider-Man franchise. There's a woman behind Hunger Games. One of the producers of The Twilight was a woman. I mean, this is crazy that women can't, quote-unquote, can't direct big-budget movies. But it's also the perception of what people think of a director. I had a director share a story the other night where they were talking to a group of kids, and, you know, what do you think a director is? What do you think a director looks like? And their example is always a guy with a little beard with a baseball hat. Hi, we all remember what Steven Spielberg looks like in all his pictures, right? So that's what people's perception of a director is. We need to show, you know, to flood the media with different pictures and different images of directors so that it's not doesn't stick. People don't dream about these things unless they feel that they can actually achieve these things. So that's one point, which is just hire. I was going to say something, you know, the F word. It's like, just hire a woman. You know, it's not that difficult. There are guys who get, you know, they come out, they direct a small, low-budget movie. Then all of a sudden, the next thing they're directing is a superhero movie. Women don't get those opportunities. The next thing is women's stories need to be looked at as equally valid to male stories. Because of the economic paradigm that exists where everything is about opening weekend, it's big budget, it's action, it's showed on a zillion screens, get in, get out kind of mentality, all those movies tend towards the male demographic, even though it's not only men going to see those. So it's really rare when you'll see a summer movie directed by a woman, even if it stars a woman, which also were not very prevalent.
It's a tough thing. I heard
Joss
Whedon had to, like, fight to get one female character into the Avengers.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough, and it's like we buy half the tickets, we go to see all the male movies. It's not like, one of the things I say, Iron Man is a success because women go with men. We buy almost half the tickets, if not half, but like a movie like a Twilight, which is so anomalous, is a success despite the fact that hardly any men go. So women can drive box office. It just has to be the right type of movie.
So I have one more question for you, because I think in a way the landscape is kind of changing in the entertainment world, where movies are losing some of their importance and television is kind of gaining. Do you think television is a more welcoming place to female creators?
It is. I just feel that. I just read a story last week on Nashville, Callie Curry, who 20 years ago wrote Thelma and Louise and just was waiting. And she's in my book talking about, and we had a conversation about Thelma and Louise and how she thought, you know, that was going to change everything, have more female protagonists. She's got this great TV show that she created in Nashville from a woman's perspective. And what happens when you have women behind the scenes, and this is film and television, actually they hire women. So for Callie Curry, she's had, I think it was 7 directors that are women on her season and 9 men. I mean, Connie Britton, who was in Friday Night Lights, who's a star of this, was just like, oh my God, that's completely unheard of. And lots of women in the writer's room, more women in the writer's room than men. Now, that's just Nashville. There are other anecdotes that show, you know, when women hire, when women are behind the scenes, look at Shonda Rhimes, there is just a ton of women, and you have different kinds of shows. And clearly, those shows are successful. So really, what TV gives women the option is not only to tell different kinds of stories, because the medium is about advertising. Everybody knows that women are the ones who buy everything, so they have to appeal to women. So the medium is appealing to women, and now slowly, and this is slow, the figures are not good, slowly you'll have a couple of shows by women. But looking at what's happening next season, I don't feel very positive about the amount of women created shows for next season. Only if you're on the CW, and now the CW is becoming a girl ghetto. So it's something that we have to look at a lot clearer, and you know, we have 1 year up, 1 year down, and that's what the statistics show. Is across the board, we're not making any progress. We're status quo.
It's almost like some women get in and then the executives in Hollywood freak out a little and get rid of them.
Right. You can't have too many girl things going on there, because then, you know, it spooks people out too much. But we think about that kind of like from people who think about gender issues, and it would be great if the studio executives only thought about kind of like dollars, because they really leave dollars at the door by not creating more product for women, especially older women who really actually have a movie going, you know, they're comfortable going to the movies. They've been going to the movies their whole lives. They like going to the movies. Look at the young guys today. They're all watching things on their iPhones. They're not developing a movie going sensibility, and that's something that's making movie executives really nervous. So if they really figured out how to give movies to people who actually went to the movies, they'd make a ton of money.
My guest today has been Melissa Silverstein. Her book, A Series of Interviews with Female Directors, is titled In Her Voice, Women Directors Talk Directing. You can follow Melissa more at blogs.indiewire.com/womeninhollywood. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Melissa. I wish we had some more time.
Thank you. And people can get the book at inhervoice.net.
Let's hear it for high school kids fighting back against school officials that insist on forcing them to listen to presentations from religious fundamentalists on how the 95% of Americans who have premarital sex are dirty, disease-ridden pariahs that aren't fit to show their face in public. The latest kid to fight back is a student at Hillsborough High School in Tennessee. The student was pushed into an abstinence-only presentation for freshmen and sophomores at the school by an anti-choice activist named Joy Wassell and a school board member named Beth Cox. This anonymous student decided to record the presentation to expose how many lies were being fed to students to scare them about sex. Those who follow abstinence until marriage programs will probably be familiar with some of these tactics.
Well, if I were to take a cup, and I were to spit into a cup, and I were to hand to this pretty young lady right here, what's your name?
Tierra.
Tierra's going to take it. She's going to spit into it. She's going to pass it around the room, and everybody's going to take a chance spitting it. We're headed to this young lady back here. What's your name?
Lizzie.
Lizzie's going to drink out of that cup. What would y'all think about that? Mm. Pretty disgusting, right? You wouldn't do it. Because you're exchanging bodily fluids, and that's what you do in sexual activity. You exchange bodily fluids, so you see how rampant it can go in terms of your sexual activity.
This tactic of comparing sex to being used as a spit bucket is pretty common in abstinence-only bullying sessions, which always makes me wonder if these people really are so unfamiliar with showers, much less the way that the vagina actually, you know, cleans itself. This demonstration is clearly meant to get kids to think of the vagina as, well, a public outhouse, as if every sexual encounter is just more semen thrown onto the pile until the woman is a big bag of different kinds of semen. The only purpose of this is to paint people, especially receptive partners in sex, as if they're dirty. And let's be clear, it was no mistake that the symbolism of the spitting in a cup thing evokes women's genitalia. She was very certain that it's women that are ruined by having sex, not men.
And ladies, you all are very emotional when you're engaging in sexual activity. And that bonding agent, there's an agent called oxytocin that is transmitted when you have sex. That's a bonding agent. And every time that you're releasing that, you become attached to whoever you've had sex with. So you're probably wondering, why these couples keep breaking up and getting back together, breaking up and getting back together? Because the woman has emotionally given herself to somebody, and it's very hard to break that bond. Because, again, we were meant to have that oxytocin with somebody that we bond with.
There's no evidence for this claim that women can only attach themselves to one person ever in their lives. Hormones don't work by burning out your receptors the first time you emit a certain hormone, or else the first time you ovulated, you'd never be able to ovulate again because your hormone receptors would be unable to read future hormonal signals to ovulate. It's true that oxytocin emits after orgasm, but that's true for men and women, and it doesn't mean that you're permanently bound to the person you had sex with forevermore. It's clear this is a myth that is not only intended to make women feel bad for having sex, but also to scare women into staying in bad relationships by telling them they'll never be able to love anyone else ever again. Unsurprisingly, Wassel used this opportunity of a captive audience to dump a bunch of anti-abortion propaganda by insisting that it's fact and not religious dogma that life begins at conception.
And that new union of sperm and egg creates that new human being, okay? At the moment of conception, all of the DNA that you have, you don't get anything else. Nothing else gets added into that, okay? Everything is right there at that moment. So according to your health textbook and all the medical textbooks and science textbooks and biology textbooks say that life begins at that moment.
That's, simply put, a lie. These mysterious textbooks she's referring to are not actual biology books or science books, but maybe religious right propaganda of the sort schools are not supposed to be using taxpayer funds to distribute. Biologists are clear. There is no set point where life begins. Life is a continuous process. Sperm are alive. Eggs are alive. Life is one big unbroken chain that goes back to when the first one-celled life form began in the primordial ooze. Nor does the unique human DNA thing change that. Each sperm cell has unique human DNA, but it's not killing for a man to ejaculate and kill millions of them at once. This is simply religious propaganda pretending to be science. Unfortunately, while there is a lot of outrage about this program in Tennessee because of the influx of anti-choice politicians making legislation over the past few decades, there's no law in Tennessee requiring schools to provide factual information during sex, quote-unquote, education programs. But hopefully this embarrassment will help change that. And now for the wisdom of wingnuts. We never took you for being a fan of contraception edition. Virginia Republican Party Treasurer Bob Fitzsimmons was interviewed recently, and he was clear where he stood on the concept of contraception.
I'm not a big fan of contraception, frankly. I think that there's some issues with giving morning after pills to 12-year-olds, and pretty soon I guess we'll hand them out, to babies. I don't know.
No one is handing out emergency contraception to 12-year-olds. Nor are there any plans to start these imaginary programs to mass distribute Plan B in junior high schools. We want anyone who needs it of any age to be able to buy it, sure. So far, I have yet to have a conservative explain to me why someone who is too young for a pill to be taken after sex is plenty old enough to be a mother.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.